And I'm going to read from 1 Corinthians chapter 9 and verse 15. Paul's been talking here about some of the rights that he has as an apostle, to be paid, to be fed, to be provided for as he brings the gospel. Rights that other people use, and absolutely have a right to do so. And then he says in verse 15, but I have not used any of these rights. And I'm not writing this in order that, in the hope that you will do such things for me. I would rather die than have anyone deprive me of this boast. Yet when I preach the gospel, I cannot boast, for I am compelled to preach. Woe to me if I do not preach the gospel. If I preach voluntarily, I've got a reward. But if not voluntarily, I'm simply discharging the trust that's been committed to me. So what is my reward? Just this. That in preaching the gospel, I may offer it free of charge and so not make use of my rights in preaching it. Although I'm free and belong to no man, I make myself a slave to everyone, to win as many as possible. To the Jews, I became like a Jew to win the Jews. To those under the law, I became like one under the law, although myself, I'm not under the law, so as to win those under the law. To those not having the law, I became like one not having the law. Although I am not in fact free from God's law, but I'm under Christ's governance. So as to win those not having the law. To the weak, I became weak to win the weak. I've become all things to all men, so that by all possible means, I might save some. And I do all of this for the sake of the gospel, that I may share in its blessings. As you came in church this morning, my absolute guess is that you probably received a copy of Woody Weekly. And if you look at the bottom of the front page, you will see the words that are our kind of mission statement as a church. Woody, a community doing all that it takes to follow Jesus and to make him known. All it takes to make Jesus known. And that's what I want to explore in the next few sermons, next few weeks' sermons. How do we do that? How do we make Jesus known in the glorious Principality of Wales in the year 2009? If you'll allow me a little bit of sort of history and looking at stuff like that, time was when I think the answer to that would have been fairly straightforward. Would have seemed fairly straightforward. If you went back, say, 300 or 400 years, the Christian faith had a privileged position in Europe and in European culture. That didn't always mean that people were open to being disciples of Jesus Christ, very far from it, but it did mean that Christians had some pretty clear, obvious strategies. One was that you could assume that the gospel was true and you could demand a response. 300 years ago, generally, people knew that the Christian message was true. They knew that the Bible was the Word of God. They knew that Jesus was the Son of God who died and rose again from the dead for us. Christian preachers didn't need to persuade people of any of that stuff. They might need to correct people's understanding of faith, but you could assume an awful lot of knowledge and understanding. The preacher or the personal evangelist could remind people of what they already knew and challenge them to make a decision on the basis of it. Even back in the 1950s and 1960s, which I can remember and I can't remember 300 years ago, Billy Graham could preach on the basis, the Bible says, and he could expect an instant response. It's actually a bit more complicated today. Billy Graham came back in 1984 and he preached at Villa Park, near where we lived in Birmingham. Our church in Yardley took dozens of folks to hear him, and we got back at the end of that about 20 response forms for people who had supposedly asked Jesus into their lives. So we went round and met them, and when we met them, we found that they actually had no idea that they had done anything of the sort. They didn't think that they had asked Jesus into their lives or anything like that. They didn't understand what Billy had said necessarily. They didn't necessarily believe it all. They had only the vaguest idea of what he had actually been talking about, no real understanding of the gospel. But they had gone forward because they had felt that there was something in what Billy Graham was saying that they wanted to explore. We aren't starting from the same place that we could start from a long time ago. Because 2009, the culture's moved on a lot in the last 25 years too. Second ploy that you could use was that you could get people involved in the life of the institutional church. And that was easy enough. You didn't have radio, you didn't have gramophones, films, television, computer, iPods, any of this stuff. There was no entertainment. The church was the center of your local community, and actually, such as it was the center of the local entertainment. And anything that you did on church premises was automatically a draw. You could say, come. Almost regardless of what you're doing, people would come. Third ploy that was used by the Roman Catholics in the time of the Middle Ages was that you could pressure and even coerce people into belief. We visited a ghastly place in the middle of Lima called the Museum of the Inquisition. And you saw the courtroom where people were tried for heresy, and you saw instruments of torture. That was a dark and demonic chapter in the history of a church that has changed a great deal since then, when they coerced people into faith, or at least the pretense of faith, by means of military crusades and threats and torture. And it was not just South American Indians who would have suffered like that, it was people like you and me who wanted to read and understand the Bible for ourselves. But this, it was open to the church to pressure and even coerce people. Now, it's pretty obvious, I think, that none of those options is open to us today. Not in Britain, at any rate. The church doesn't have a privileged position anymore. We've had 300 years of propaganda saying that science has disproved God. A few years ago, there was a series of programs on the BBC called Sea of Faith. And it was outlining the men and the movements that have challenged the truth of the Christian faith over the last couple of hundred years. And they trotted out Freud and Feuerbach and Nietzsche and Karl Marx and Charles Darwin. Actually, the arguments have not been all that strong over those 200 years, but the noise has been deafening. That has said Christianity is a thing of the past. It's unbelievable. Our culture has developed, especially in the 18th and 19th centuries, developed a kind of self-confidence that said, well, of course, in the past we needed God. When we had problems, we prayed about them. But no, we don't need God anymore. We're masters of our own destiny. We have now grown up. We're independent. Then if you look at the church as the center of the local community, that's redundant. Mass media, the breakdown of the extended family, urbanization, there are all kinds of things that have taken away the church's role at the center of communities. Indeed, in lots of places in Britain, you don't even have real communities anymore. And what's more, people distrust institutions, don't they just? I mean, we've had all this stuff about Parliament in the last few days and MPs' expenses, and people are massively cynical about the institutions of government. People are cynical about the institution of the police. A couple of generations ago, my parents never thought that it was possible for a policeman ever to get anything wrong. We've moved some way from that. And the church, the institution of the church. We are all in the same boat, where people once respected the church because it was the church. They clearly don't any longer. And they will seize on every scandal with a TV evangelist and every instance of child abusing priests to justify their cynicism. It doesn't matter if there's only half a dozen instances across quite a large world, but people have a default mode of distrust towards institutions, and that includes us. And then again today, if people want spirituality, they won't necessarily look to Christianity. They are just as likely to look to Buddhism or the New Age or paganism or any of these things. We live in a kind of supermarket of faiths these days. And ours is just one of very many brands. Indeed, in the eyes of some, I mean, Christianity is a kind of Woolworths. Once it was a great brand, but it's kind of lost its way and it's not offering anything that the others don't offer much better these days. And now it's out of touch and a thing of the past. And the image that a lot of people have of Christian faith is that we're a kind of Woolworths amongst the supermarkets. And finally, we're in a situation where there is a growing movement that argues stridently that religion itself is a bad thing. A couple of generations ago, people might not have been religious, but they kind of thought that religion was a good thing because it taught morality and all that sort of stuff. And increasingly, there are people who argue quite stridently that religion is the cause of war and conflict and prejudice and ignorance, and the sooner the world gets rid of it, lock, stock and barrel, every single faith that there is, the better we'll all be because of it. And all of that's changed the scenery in which we're presenting Christ. Now, my apologies if you've heard stuff like this 100 times before, and some of you I know have. But it is basically true, and it's a bit of a wake-up call for the church. We cannot do what we've done before. We cannot say the things that we've said before in the same way. We cannot trog around the same patterns of church life that we've been around before and expect it to be effective in our present time. There is a call here to different approaches to evangelism, and I think perhaps even different ways of doing church. And I need to immediately at this point to say that I speak as a lousy evangelist. I don't speak as an expert. I don't even speak as a halfway decent witness who takes most of the opportunities that I get and really nails them down. I am a lousy evangelist, so if you also are a lousy evangelist this morning, please don't get discouraged. Please don't switch off, because we're in this together. So that's where we are. The interesting thing is that when you turn back to the Bible, our present situation, 2009 is very much like the situation that the early church faced in the first century AD. Because in New Testament times, the church had no privileged position either. They were commending the Christian faith in the middle of a hypermarket of different faiths. There were mystery religions, there were emperor religions, there were Greek religions, there were all kinds of stuff flooding the market, and Christianity came into this hypermarket of different faiths, needing to make its way. They faced hostility as we do. They faced hostility from the Jews, who saw the Christian faith as a betrayal of their national hopes. They wanted a Messiah who was going to kick out the Romans, and Christianity patently didn't do that. In fact, it had a rather feeble cross at the center of the whole thing. They faced hostility from Greeks who saw the Christian faith as being ridiculously naive. Real truth was about philosophy and stuff in the ether. And here were Christians talking about history and real human beings. And what's that got to do with real religion? Increasingly, they faced hostility from the Roman Empire, who labeled Christians as atheists, because Christians refused to worship the Roman gods and goddesses, and especially they refused to worship the emperor. They rejected the gods. They were atheists. Beyond the pale. So that's the situation that the Christian church grew up in. It's a complicated one. And that's kind of reflected in those verses that we read. Paul's having to say, look, amongst the Jews, I got alongside them. People under the law, I identified with them. People not under the law, completely different sort of category of people. I identified with where they were. People who are weak, lots of different sort of combinations and permutations here. How did the first century church respond? Well, they were creative, they were flexible, they were multi-layered. If I can express this in terms of a sporting analogy, they were not one club golfers, just bring a putter to do all the driving and everything, as if one club would do the whole job. They used every iron in the bag. They regularly, this is fascinating, went places for Christ that they'd never been before. Philip runs across the desert towards a chariot, and puffing and blowing, he asks the VIP inside, what are you reading? Can I help explain it to you? And that's an evangelistic opportunity. Peter, a Jew to the bootstraps, somebody to whom going into a Gentile home was absolute anathema, visits the home of a Gentile, a Roman centurion, for goodness sake, and he starts talking there in that alien environment about Jesus. Paul and Silas become captive preachers. Now you've heard of captive audiences who can't get away, but these were captive preachers because in the Philippi jail, stuck in their prison cell, they speak to anyone who'll listen about Christ. Paul ends up at the Athenian Debating Society on Mars Hill, sharing arguments with the Greek philosophers. He's invited to defend himself in a variety of king's palaces and governor's mansions and gives his testimony. And indeed, the guy is so straightforward about this. He's supposed to be sort of giving the, you know, a defense of his behavior so that he's not actually sent to the firing squad or whatever. And he's so upfront about commending Christ in the middle of all this that one of the puppet kings named Agrippa interrupts him mid-sentence. He said, "Paul, stop! You're trying to make us to become Christians, aren't you? That's not what you're here for." So Paul speaks for Christ on the deck of a ship that's just about to go under. It's fascinating to read through Acts and see some of these real groundbreaking situations that the early Christians were prepared to go into to share the Lord. They used a wide variety of approaches. I want to outline just a few of them. There's friendship. Paul connects with the jailer in his prison cell. He makes a friend of the Roman centurion, Julius, on the boat to Rome. Philip strikes up the conversation with the stranger in the chariot. It's difficult to share our faith with someone that we're not connected with. And I think this is one of the big challenges to those of us who have been Christians for a long time, that we simply do not have, many of us, real strong connection with any non-Christians. But the early Christians were great at doing that, actually making connection, building friendship. There's testimony. People are often skeptical about theory, but you talk about them about something that's real to you and it connects. I think that one could sense that last Sunday as the guys were sharing their personal stories of what Christ meant to them. There are loads of instances of personal experience at the heart of New Testament evangelism. The 12, when they speak about Jesus and the cross and the resurrection, they're not just saying, "This is what we read, this is what we think." They're saying, "We were there, we're witnesses. We were on the spot. This is our experience." Paul tells the story of his life with Jesus on every possible occasion, to the Jews in Jerusalem, to Roman governor Felix and his successor Festus, to King Agrippa, his wife Bernice. It doesn't always go well. He always shares his testimony if he's got half a chance. There's signs and wonders. One of the things that punctuates the book of Acts is the supernatural power of God and supernatural spiritual gifts. They were not an occasional thing. They're a constant. They're always there. And they didn't happen behind closed doors. You know, we've made all of this sort of stuff, prophetic, healing ministry and all that sort of stuff. It's something that happens in church. We have special services for it. It didn't happen like that in the early church. Most of it was happening out in the marketplace. The guy at the beautiful gate outside the temple, who's the crippled beggar who's healed. The disciples speaking in tongues on the streets on the day of Pentecost. The miracles that are done on the streets of Samaria. In fact, in Acts chapter 8 and verse 5 and 6, it says, Philip went down to a city in Samaria and proclaimed Christ there. When the crowds heard Philip, and when they saw the miraculous signs that he did, they all paid close attention to what he said. Of course they did. Of course they did. And the truth is that we could spend half the morning giving examples of how people and situations in the book of Acts were opened up to the gospel of Jesus Christ because of the miracles and the spiritual gifts that people saw with their own eyes. There is, fourthly, proclamation and persuasion. If we were using a fancy word for this today, we would call it apologetics. That very simply, it doesn't mean saying sorry for what you believe. It means giving a reason for what you believe. And you've got that all the way through the New Testament. In the Jewish synagogues, they argued the case for Christ from the Old Testament scriptures. In the Athenian debating society, Paul argues the case for Christ, quoting Greek poets and philosophers. There are places where Paul has to argue logically and philosophically for the reality of the Creator God of the Old Testament, because if people don't get hold of that, they won't understand anything else about the gospel. There are places where he's marshalling historical evidence for the resurrection of Jesus and saying to the guys, look at this. You may have been told, as I have more times than I've had hot dinners, that it is really unspiritual if we try to reason with people when we're sharing the gospel. If you've been told that, this is the time to forget it, because there is not an iota of truth in it. If you doubt that, just take a glance at Acts chapter 17. In verse 2, it says, as Paul's custom was... He did this all the time. He went into the synagogue, and on three Sabbath days he reasoned with them from the scriptures, explaining and proving that the Christ had to suffer and rise from the dead. He faces a bit of aggro in Thessalonica where this is happening. He moves on to a place called Berea, and in verse 11 it says, now the Bereans were of more noble character than the Thessalonians, for they received the message with great eagerness and examined the scriptures every day to see if what Paul said was true. Many of the Jews believed. See, I find that really interesting, because not only was it Paul's custom to reason about the gospel, he did it all the time, but he welcomed it when his listeners used their minds to examine if what he said was true. He didn't expect them to sort of take it or leave it. He didn't say, well, here it is. You can receive this if you want to, but don't ask too many questions. He wanted them to ask questions. He wanted them to examine it to see if it was true. And when they did, lots of people became Christians. That's the biblical pattern. Now I want to reflect some of those approaches to evangelism in the remaining sermons in this series, which is entitled All It Takes. In the third sermon, which is going to be, I think, on the 31st of May in the second service, I want to deal with apologetics. And I think the best way to do that is not for me just to talk about apologetics and what a good thing it is and all that sort of stuff. I think probably the best way to do this is to do some apologetics. There is a little bit of a risk of egg on omelets on the face here, but what I'd like to invite you to do is to email me or write down for me any questions that you like that block non-Christians from coming to faith, especially if they're non-Christians that you know. And I will do my best on that occasion, on the morning of the 31st of May, I think it is, to give short, straightforward answers. If we have time on that Sunday, I will also give the opportunity on the day for anyone who wants to ask a question from the floor. As I say, we have a risk of some egg on the face, but let's try it. And the other thing I have to say here is I'm depending on you here. If we have questions, I'll try and answer them. If we don't have questions, we might have a long, tedious half hour of silence in place of the normal sermon. But that's the third sermon in the series. And I think that's really important, because, guys, isn't it true that if folks ask us awkward questions about Christian faith, if we don't at least manage to engage with them, they often will not get past that. They often will not get past it. In the fourth sermon, I'm going to try and persuade Chris Lawrence to talk about evangelism through service and also through signs and wonders and prophetic words. And again, there might be one or two folks here who would be asking, well, what place has service got in being a servant got in evangelism? What place has signs and wonders got in evangelism today? Well, Sue and I were in Peru last month, as most of you know by now. Part of the reason for that was we were visiting two missionary friends of ours, a couple called Bill and Jean. Now, I don't know how effective they are in evangelism, but I'll tell you this, that what they are doing gives everybody who knows them opportunities to share Christ that we otherwise wouldn't have. happened a number of times, just in those 2 weeks that we were out in Peru. So what are you doing out here in Peru? Well, actually, we're visiting friends who came out from the UK to work in the shanty towns around Lima. That's fantastic. What made them want to come out here? Bingo. Or what are they doing then? Again, bingo. Even when we were on holiday in Menorca a few years ago, there was somebody talking about all their foreign trips, and I was able to say, well, I've only ever been to South America a couple of times, and that's because partly because we got friends out there who are working with folks in the shanty towns in Peru. Again, immediately folks are saying, tell me about it. Now, let me be honest. I mean, I don't always take the opportunities I have to give a decent witness for the Lord, but just about every single time that I can mention our friends Bill and Jean in a conversation, I get the opportunity to share about Christ because people respect what they're doing. Some of you who do hydration stations, probably it's more direct than this, because as you give out the water, people will ask the questions and you get the opportunity to witness. But even if you don't give the opportunities when you're serving, there's a whole community behind you that you're opening doors for when you serve, that we get an opportunity to speak about Christ on your behalf. So, I know there are guys going off on the mission over the summer. I suppose one of the ways that will help us to open doors in our own personal witness is to get alongside one of them, support them maybe. And then the supernatural. We were having breakfast in our hotel in Cusco. And we got into conversation with a loopy Australian woman. My apologies to anyone who's an Australian. I'm not suggesting that every Australian is loopy, but this particular one was. We got talking about sort of faith, and she was keen to share her beliefs with us. She really was. It turned out she was a generalist. You're wondering what a generalist is? So was I. A generalist means that every religion is a perfect path to God, even though they contradict each other. It means that God is so far above us that we can't possibly know anything at all about him, so all of the creeds are redundant. Except for at least 10 dogmatic statements she was on the verge of making about God that she absolutely knew. So he wasn't as unknowable as all that. Being a generalist turned out to mean that you understand every religion better than people who've invested their entire lives in studying it. So you understand Hinduism better than the Hindus. You understand Christianity better than the Christians. You understand Judaism better than the Jews. You just know, although you've never opened a Bible, that it teaches reincarnation. As I say, she was loopy. She seemed entirely impervious to argument or reason. There was nothing that I could say, at any rate, that could puncture her absolute pig ignorant certainty. Bless her. Lovely girl. I came away from breakfast and I thought, what might have got through to her? Well, it wasn't logic. It wouldn't have been reason. Probably not even testimony. But what if we had had a prophetic word that spoke direct into her life? What if we had been able to pray for her for some illness that she had and God actually worked through that? Maybe there are places in people's hearts that only a supernatural work of God will ever, ever open up. And yes, we need that in our armory as well. That's the fourth sermon, I think. The fifth sermon in the series will be the last one. I want to finish by asking the question, what kind of a church will it take to reach our generation for Christ? That's a good question. Probably get some interesting answers. But next week in the second sermon, we need to focus on another question, and that is probably the most important of the lot. What kind of people will it take? And that's probably the most vital question of all, because what we do comes out of who we are, and we can only share what we've got, and we'll only get listened to if what we say reflects something that's visibly living in us. And I don't think it's any accident that you read all the letters in the New Testament and there's very little about direct evangelism, but there's ream after ream about the dynamics of Christ living in us and actually the quality of our own life in Him. That's a big question. What kind of people will we need to be? There was... I thought it was Jason, but it turns out to have been Sam who used the phrase last Sunday, so I can't say it in the Yorkshire accent. It's not a question of ability so much as availability. It's not a question of ability as much as availability. That ain't the whole truth, but it's a darn large part of it. That's the thing I want to challenge us with just today as we come to the close of this sermon. You and I have probably got misgivings about sharing our faith. We've made a hash of it in the past, perhaps, where we're nervous. We know that we lack ability. There will be questions that we can't answer. We maybe haven't a lot of experience. We maybe haven't got a huge amount of confidence. I think we need to be upfront with ourselves and with God about that, not pretend anything. I want also to say, and this isn't in my notes, that I believe that God has given each of us something. And you might have listened to a lot of what I said and the apologetic, I couldn't possibly do that. You might have listened to the stuff about using spiritual gifts and I haven't got spiritual gifts. There is something in that you've got that God has put in your life. If it's no more than an ability to make friendships, if it's no more than an ability to share your testimony, and I believe that God is wanting to build some of this other stuff into us as well. But the challenge this morning really is, am I willing to be available for God to use me to work through me, to bring others, to share this massive treasure of Jesus Christ in our lives? I'm going to invite the band to come forward, and they're going to just lead us in the last part of our service in a second. I want just to encourage us to take a moment. I want to just encourage you in two things. One is to recognize that God has put something in you that qualifies you to speak of Him. Might not have all the gifts. Might not feel as if you've got any, but you have. Because God has put something in each of us that qualifies us to speak of what He's done in our lives, what He means to us. Take encouragement from that. Build on it. And the second thing is to invite you just to stand with me as your way of saying, Lord, with all the things that I haven't got, I'm prepared to be available for you to work with and work through and speak through to touch the lives of others. So I want to encourage you actually physically to stand, especially if that is something that you are prepared to affirm in your own heart. God, I'm available. Heaven knows I don't feel equipped, but I am available.